Hi, could you please state your name?
Sam Littlefield, 6'1", Los Angeles, and I'm vaccinated. The new addition that they have to... Yeah.
Well, hello. Welcome to Slate Your Name, the podcast where an actor talks to other actors about acting and how it makes them feel. I'm your host, Michael McMillan, and this week I am sitting down with Sam Littlefield, who you may know from Batwoman on HBO Max or The Leftovers on regular HBO. Sam is a really interesting, talented, thoughtful actor, and I'm really excited for you guys to hear this conversation. This one was probably the most personal conversation I've had with anyone yet, not just because Sam and I actually went to the same performing arts high school together back in the day, and this is the first time I've sat down with him in a very long time and caught up, and I learned things about Sam that I never knew, and you will too. But before we get to that, let's have a quick company meeting. Don't forget to follow us at Slate Your Name Pod over, or Slate Your Name Podcast, excuse me, over on Instagram. Send in some questions as well. We've been doing these over on the Patreon, Slate Your Name, The Green Room. But I want to encourage a little bit more conversation between me and you guys. That was grammatically incorrect, wasn't it? I should say between you guys and me. So I put out an APB for questions on my own Instagram at McMills, and I got a couple bites. Here's one question. It's actually part of it's part two of a two-parter. I know this is unorthodox, guys. This is from Instagram user Joanna Little 270, and she asks, how do you deal with getting older, knowing it'll be harder to get parts? Want to kick this episode off with a little existential crisis? Thanks, Joanna. You know, there are parts for every age. I do think that Hollywood, in particular, loves the youthful. But I think it's more a matter of navigating between stages in your life. At some points, you will be more castable than others. And that's not just based on age. That's also based on the way you come across at certain ages. Listen, when I was 23, I played 15, 16 years old. I still looked like a high schooler. All through my 30s, people were like, he still looks kind of young. But he's in his 30s, but I don't know if he passes as like the dad yet. As I get older, I'll start to pass as the dad, and then those dad roles, those wonderful, wonderful dad roles will come rolling in. Yeah, I mean, it's a lifelong career. And so there are periods where you just don't look like any age. Or there's periods where I had friends who I just knew from school, like they weren't gonna hit their stride until they were like a little bit older, like in their 30s or 40s. Funny story. Is it a funny story, Michael? We'll find out. It's not really a funny story, but I remember working with Dennis O'Hare on True Blood. And Dennis O'Hare was talking about how he really didn't get his first roles until he was like 32, 33, 34. He spent a good 10, 12 years just like not getting cast, because I think as he aged into his type, those roles started to open up for him. It's hard. Yeah, you got to be patient. A lot of patience comes along with this career. And when you are a ambitious little bastard, sometimes that's hard to wait around. Thanks for the question, Joanna. If you have questions that you want me to answer, if you have advice you need, if you want to know what kind of dog that is barking, please write in to me at Slate Your Name. Hold on a second. So sorry about that. I had to politely ask those dogs to be quiet. Write into me with your questions at slateyournamepodcast@gmail.com. You know what? Coming to meeting over, okay? That's enough. You guys are dismissed. Now get back in the audience because the show's about to begin. What weird theater is this where the guy who's putting on the show is calling a company meeting with the audience? It makes no sense. Here is my conversation with Sam Littlefield. Hello, Sam Littlefield. Welcome to Slate Your Name.
Hi, Michael McMillan. How are you?
I'm doing really well. You know, you and I have a very fun shared history where we both played old men when we were 17 or 18 years old in a production of Pygmalion.
Whoa, I totally forgot. That's right. Yeah.
That's one of those acting school things that happens when you're a kid, when you're in high school and college, that doesn't happen to you as soon as you get out into the business. Like, you play old characters. It's like the only time in your life until you're like in your 60s, 70s, 80s that you'll play old men. I played Eliza Doolittle. I played Doolittle, Eliza's dad, and you played Colonel Pickering. And we both were like men in their 70s.
That is so funny. I remember that was like right when I got to Interlochen, and I had this total identity freak out where I was like, what is acting? Are you the character, or is the character? Like, I was so overly psychoanalyzing it that I completely forgot that it's just like, pretend. You know?
Yeah, you forget a lot of times, especially when you're young, that like, oh, this should be fun. We should mention for our listeners, Interlochen is referring to Interlochen Arts Academy. That's like a school for theater, music, dance. I've mentioned it a couple times on this show. But you do forget when you're a kid that like, it is supposed to be play. It is supposed to be fun. But when you're taking like, you know, serious acting classes, it can feel intimidating. You know,
totally.
I don't think that. Where? How did you get to Interlochen, and where were you from originally?
Salt Lake City, Utah. I was dabbling in, not dabbling, I did a lot of like local theater there. I was in Nine, the musical, when I was like 9 years old. And that, even like today, was one of the most magical experiences. I was just surrounded. One of the cat women on the original Batman series played Lillian Lafleur. Do you know Nine at all?
Yes, yes, yeah. It's the musical based on 8 and a half, correct?
Yes, correct. But I was just surrounded by all of these like fabulous, really beautiful women. And I was 9 years old and there were all of these incredible costumes. And anyway, so I started, there and I was doing... You know, I was like in Evita and a bunch of different shows over there. And then, yeah, and then I moved to Interlochen. And
so were these like professional? Obviously,
yes.
If like, so which Catwoman do you remember? Was it Julie Newmar, Eartha Kitt?
Marilyn Montgomery. She was like the fourth installment on the show.
Yeah, they were just cranking out Catwomen on that original 66 series.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, totally.
Also a little fortuitous that, you know, who knew that like the Batman universe would come back into your life in a real way.
I never made that connection, Michael. That was a beautiful, you made the full circle. Yeah, it's true.
I do love this idea of like young Sam in Salt Lake City, just surrounded by these actresses and doing these professional musicals. That's so cool. How did you even start to get it, break into the professional world at such a young age?
Okay, so in third grade, I wrote and directed this play just in my like science class.
Yeah, you did.
How do they let me do it in science class? I don't know. But How Magic Came to Be. And it was like this 2.5 page long play about like how Athena and Zeus, they, you know, are walking down the street and they're bored. And so then they make magic. I mean, it was, I read it maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And it's, you know, there's just no structure. But my teacher, Mrs. Dick, she referred me. She, like, I just got a call from Salt Lake Acting Company. And yeah, they said Mrs. Dick. I mean, it's kind of like a Hollywood story. Like,
you know, like, yeah. You wrote a spec script. Uh-huh. You got discovered, and then you got ushered into the professional world. It is exactly like something that might happen out here.
And I felt so famous. Like,
of course you did. Yes.
I was making, like, you know, I don't know how much you make, $200, $300 a week, and you're like 9 years old, and you get to have all these cool experiences. It probably ruined me for the rest of my life. Constantly, like, you know, seeking that, you know, same sort of stimuli.
Yeah, I do love that you were like, they asked me to write a report on giraffes, but instead I'm writing a fantasy musical starring Zeus and Athena for science class.
Well, I'm trying to remember because, how old are you? But right before that, I guess the real thing is my family, we did this big trip to Europe and we went and saw Phantom of the Opera. And so my grandma was playing Phantom of the Opera for me. And so then I produced a full neighborhood production of Phantom of the Opera where we basically just lip-synced through the whole thing. So that was my precursor to how magic came to be. I just really want to make sure that the timeline is...
Got it, yes. We need this for archival purposes. I love that there seems to be a recurring pattern, too, of, like, older women ushering you through your early career. You have the former Catwoman, you have Grandma, you have Mrs. Yeah. Dick, like really, really being your early patrons.
I think that's really true. Yeah, I think that energy has always kind of been with me throughout my entire career. Older women who are incredible. Yeah.
So you left the boards of the Salt Lake City theaters, and then you went up north to Michigan to Interlochen Arts Academy. And were you, that was your what, junior year, senior year? How many years were you at Interlochen?
It was my junior year. And I got there and I basically just kind of shat my pants. I just had no idea what was going on and was so intimidated. It was so many incredibly talented people. Do you remember, like, Megan Fox?
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah, it was just so much talent, and I just didn't know. I had no idea where I fit into that world. I don't think anyone else did. I don't think anyone else did either.
None of us did. I mean, I remember when I got there my junior year, which was, I was a year, I think, ahead of you, a year or two ahead of you. I just remember arriving and being like, oh my gosh, there's like this whole storyline of people that are going to school here, and I'm like the new kid, and I'm just trying to catch up. And there were so, like you said, they're intimidated by how talented everybody was.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, when I got there, there was like an embarrassing moment where I was like, maybe I create a whole new identity for myself. Maybe there was like a moment where I was like, I'm going to call myself Felix. Like, I wanted completely rewrite my personality. And then quickly was like, no, this is very weird. Just be yourself and you'll get through it. But I think you have, especially at a young age, you're like, I'm in a new place. Nobody knows me. I could kind of do whatever I want. It was the closest thing to a fresh start or a clean slate I think I've ever had in my life.
Wow. Well, and I feel like that was, I think, kind of the difference between you and me in that world. I mean, when I met you, you just seemed so confident and in your body, and you were kind of just like riding high and ruling the world. And I had a calendar that I would mark off every day that I was there. And then sometimes I would wait like 4 or 5 days so that I'd have the satisfaction of marking off 4 or 5 more days. I mean, I just was lost there.
That sucks. I wish I hadn't been so far up my ass that I could have like been a better friend or person to be like, hey, don't sweat it. Let's have fun. Let's make this a good time, you know. But I wasn't mature enough to, you know, see that in other people. That sucks. That sucks. It sucks when something that you're enjoying and you think is great is a bummer for somebody else.
Well, yeah. But also, how could you have known? I mean, especially in high school where everyone's just trying to figure out who the hell they are. I mean, that's sweet of you, Michael. But in that time, I think those are the moments where you do start building yourself up and figuring out who you are. And actually, I mean, like leaving Interlaken, when I left Interlaken and I was like, okay, holy shit, I'm free from this. Now I can start like, you know, making my, you know, changing my name to Mr. Grumbles or, you know, building the blocks to become the person that I want to hope to try to be, you know?
Right. Well, and it wasn't you. I also feel like you were getting cast and you were doing stuff at school. You know what I mean? At Interlaken, like you got a lead role pretty early on, or one of the lead roles in Pygmalion. So it wasn't. Do you feel like you were restrained creatively or weren't being noticed? What do you think it was?
I think that the bar was like so high with, you know, talent and production level. And also our teachers were, you know, and we had some like hardcore, like really held your feet to the fire. And they wanted, you know, David Monti, who I'm actually doing a play with right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
So 9 years ago, we did this. Awesome. Is this okay that we're like divert, like taking?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what this show's about.
Oh, fun. We're doing, so we did Three Sisters. It took place in Maine in the 90s.
It's cool.
It's a funny sort of take on the piece. But yeah, so David Monti, our teacher, who was intense and like I was incredibly intimidated by. I had this amazing full circle experience of doing Three Sisters with him in this sort of house installation piece. And we're coming up on 10 years, on the 10-year anniversary of doing that production, and we're all getting back together and doing it again. But what was the original question?
Well, first of all, that's amazing. I love the idea that you guys are coming back. What theater company is this with?
I don't know, even know if we have a name. Nick Westrate, this incredible. Do you know Nick?
I love Nick. I've got to get Nick on the podcast. I'd love to get David on the podcast as well, because, you know, he was such a big influence, you know, as a teacher.
I fucking love that. Both of those ideas. That's Nick is so brilliant and bright and talented. And David is all of those things, too, in different, you know, his own individual way.
How did you leave Interlaken, and then, so your senior year, I assume you were back in Salt Lake City. How did you leave that world behind? And then get back into it. It seems like it found you again, because Nick also went to Interlaken after we were there. How did Nick come back? It seems like it didn't want you to. It was like, no, sorry, we're a part of you now.
Well, what I do think Interlaken did is it kind of made me abandon theater. And I, that's when I kind of started to fall. That kind of makes me sad. But, you know, and that's when all those like cool, you know, movie, like Existenz, Cronenberg, and all of those movies were coming out that were so, you know, interesting and 90s. And. Mm-hmm. I really started investigating film and TV, and I don't think TV was really that cool back then, but
no, it was about to get cool. It was still pretty like network, you know, it was ABC, NBC, CBS, and then that was about it. But like Sopranos hadn't quite started yet. HBO was just starting to do some premium scripted stuff. So you really felt like, you know, if you were coming up in the 90s as a kid, you're like, I'm either going to get like a bad sitcom if I'm lucky, or I'm going to be in like a Quentin Tarantino movie like you did. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, it was such a different landscape.
Totally. Well, you know, real quick, what did it for me was the original Roswell on the WB, back when the WB was the WB. And I had such this like charged spiritual connection with this show about aliens in high school.
I love it.
And
that was X-Files for me. That was really me and X-Files. Okay. Yeah. I, for some reason, missed Roswell, maybe because I was at Interlochen and then college and didn't have like easy access to TV. But yeah. X-Files, I would watch the reruns in the summer. Go on. I apologize.
I had dreams about Roswell, and I, you know, we would have these, like, me and my friend Eowyn, we would have these ceremonial viewing parties of watching. I mean, I doubt it holds up. Like, I bet if I watched it now, I mean, like, I can't say that. Who knows? Maybe it's great.
I mean, maybe it is great. Maybe it doesn't matter. What's so funny is I think you've tapped into something that I think for young actors is, I don't want to say, maybe it's important, but like, I think happens.
Yeah.
And you just jogged something in my memory where, like, I had a very emotional pre-Interlock and a very emotional connection to the show, My So-Called Life.
Yeah.
Like, that was the first time I think I watched a show where I was like, this is where I want to go. Where are they filming this? Like, I had a huge crush on Claire Danes. I kept, writing in my headcanon what role I would play on the show.
Totally.
You know, watched it over and over. They started, like, it was short-lived, but they reran it every afternoon on MTV. And I would, like, run down to the basement all by myself, like, watch My So-Called Life and just, again, dream about it. And I wonder if there's almost this thing that happens where it is almost like you're creating this sort of ritual to manifest this thing for yourself.
Yeah.
Because look, we both went on to go do TV. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, there is. I think the thing that all of us are connected to, anyone who's an actor or I guess an artist, it all starts with this deep spiritual understanding of, I guess, this kind of celebration of human experience. And it does start, I mean, it started for me just so young, you know, where you see these archetypes and these experiences that these people are going through in such a beautiful way. You can't help it. You just can't help it, but try and do it as much as you possibly can for the rest of your life.
Yeah, there really is something this hasn't come up on the podcast yet, but there is something to, and I know we're getting into kind of like woo-woo territory, but there really is something about visualization and manifestation. And I feel like that's an ability that I had really strongly when I was younger and have lost it a little bit. Are there times in your career where you've been like, this is what I want. I know specifically what it is. I see it as sharply as I used to see myself in my Roswell dreams. And I'm making that happen.
Well, there's one really, I guess I'll talk about this. So The Leftovers. Have you watched The Leftovers?
I have to admit, it's one of the few HBO shows that I have not watched yet.
Oh.
And I've had it. I knew you were on it. I've had it on my playlist, and I keep going, this is the next series I'm going to binge, and I haven't done it yet. But I know I have friends who were watching and were like, this is the best show on TV right now.
Yeah. So it follows this. It's such a good show. You really should watch it. But I was watching the first season, and I guess I'm talking about this. It's a 2% or 7% of the population just immediately disappears, and it follows this one family where the mother leaves the family and joins this cult where everyone wears white and they don't speak. And my mom left our family and joined a cult where everyone wears white and they don't speak.
Whoa.
And so I was watching this show, and my sister, you know, was up in Seattle watching this show, and we were both, because I don't know how many people like have family members that join extremist cults, but
it happens, but probably fewer, they're probably in the minority, but it obviously happens.
Yeah. I just was having such a soulful experience watching my personal experience be on being reflected back at me. And I was telling my agent, I was telling everyone, my friend and I made this like little documentary thing that I was gonna like send to producers, and I didn't. I like chickened out and didn't do it. And then I got a call to audition for The Leftovers, and I booked it. And was on cloud 14. That week was like my endorphins were just, I remember sitting at this restaurant, this really packed restaurant for lunch, and I'm just sitting there and my eyes are like up in the air and I've got this like corny smile on my face just because I'm just so happy that I'm in this story and I'm working with all of these people that I'm intimidated to work with, but that's so exciting because I don't know. There's something about when you're like in a room with people where you're like, okay, everyone's a little bit better than me. and I've got to step up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I did. Like, I didn't interlock in it. I didn't crumble. I chose to dance with it. And that was, yeah, because I think that is real. I think that when you really do, when you're, we're talking so much about like spirit, like, but.
Great.
I think when you are able to like really access that, you know, that thing, I think sometimes you are really able to, it's like The Secret. Did you ever see The Secret?
Yes, of course. Me neither. I don't endorse it, but when that was all happening, of course, because I'm also into, like, you know, all sorts of UFOs and ghosts and Bigfoot and all this stuff, you know what I mean? So, like, this idea of the law of attraction or manifesting stuff, I think, of course, it sounds intriguing to me. And being in a career that feels so dictated by mystery and trying to figure out, like, what's the trick? What is the trick? I need to find the trick to get the job. You're going to turn to some of these things. And like I said, I do think there is something to, like, when you really connect, like in that moment watching The Leftovers and it impacts you personally. First of all, I'm sorry your mom, that's wild. I'm so sorry that happened. Were you young when that happened?
It's been kind of a long, I'm trying to even think if she was, she was involved in it during Interlochen, and it was kind of a slow uncoiling where you know, someone's kind of like slowly walking out of the room and out the door and in their car and driving away and you're probably never gonna, but it took a while for it actually to fully occur, which I think happens a lot with these kind of organizations. You know, it's good. I mean, I love her from afar, you know, and there's something, you know, she wrote me once and she said, I've noticed that your career's been doing a lot better since I have left. And I think that there's some truth to that, because I think that when you're freed from those things that are tugging at you, that are painful, that you can't release. I can't believe we're talking about this, but what the hell?
I'm here to receive it, and I hope we're cool. We can talk about whatever you want. And I think this is important, because obviously these personal things that happen to us impact us as artists, and it creates those moments where you're watching something and you're like, holy fuck, I can't believe this show exists. I can't believe I relate to it on a personal level. And especially in a landscape like Hollywood, where most you know, let's be honest, most of this stuff is commercially driven. It's very shallow at times. When you see something that impacts you in that way, that's being made on a big platform, of course you want to join it because you have something to say about it.
Totally. And there is, yeah, there's a thing of like, I belong here. I understand this. This is helping me. This is great. This is like...
Good.
I can... I mean, I told you earlier, but I'm on this like kind of road trip. I got a multi-city train pass and I'm going up and down the coast. One great thing about living in LA is you make so many friends and then they leave and that's sad, but it gives for so many places for you to be able to visit and get some clarity before kind of going back into the gauntlet. But yeah, that's good for me to kind of remember as I'm kind of doing this to, you know, think about and, you know, coming back and doing it.
Do you feel like doing the leftovers provided some, aside from helping you sort of raise you up to a level where you're like, all right, I got to meet these people where they're at. Did you find it cathartic? Did it help work or I'm not somebody, by the way, who thinks that acting is therapy. I think therapy is therapy.
Yeah.
But I do think art can provide catharsis, not only for the artist, but for obviously audiences as well. Did you find that any doing that show, once you got there, once you were like, okay, now I'm here, did it help process any of that old pain or any of that stuff? Did it help? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. What I think it did for me was it gave me confidence to, you know, there's just, when you're in LA and you're in the minutia and you're doing these, you know, commercials for Preparation H and you're not booking them, you're like, I can't. I'm not even worth a Preparation H commercial.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
But it was the first time I was doing something that I really respected, that I was in, and I was sitting at the table, spine erect, and being like, I belong here, you know? I mean, I belong here. And I think that that's a really... I remember hearing this thing that, like, Amy Adams was saying about Drop Dead Gorgeous. You know, she'd booked Drop Dead Gorgeous, and then I think she was doing... I mean, I don't totally remember the story, but she was then doing dinner theater and everything, but she was saying that experience of doing Drop Dead Gorgeous was so huge for me because... just having that moment of drop in and being like, okay, I did do that. I did have that experience and I rocked it and I can do it again. I can find it again. And I think those markers are important to help you keep going. And I think they're kind of like little North Star moments or whatever, you know?
100%. Yeah. Those moments where you're like, oh, not only can I do this, I can exceed my expectations, and sometimes something magical really does happen where it feels like the universe kind of looked back and was like, hey, I've got something for you. I know you're going to relate to this, you know? And I wonder, and again, this is sort of the mystery of the way, I guess just the way the world works in general, but like, I do wonder if you hadn't had that personal connection, would you still book that job, or would that audition even come along?
Yeah, I wonder that.
Yeah.
Because it's not like my character had anything to do with any of that. I mean, I played a Swedish crackhead scalper who was like ripping people off and had a massive samurai bun on my head. And I, yeah, so there was no, I don't know. Maybe we'll know when we're, I don't know. Maybe we'll never know. Maybe we'll never know.
Yeah, we might not. Well, we're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Sam. All right, I'm sitting down with Sam Littlefield here in the Slate Your Name theater. Sam, you know, I was just thinking about something during the break where it's interesting to me that, you know, you started off, you know, leaving home and not feeling like you belonged, and then that moment of being in that room or being at that table read at Leftovers and being like, aha, this is it. Like, now there was, you know, that's a very empowering, like, must have been an empowering moment.
Definitely. It definitely was. Yeah. And I feel like I just keep, well, like all of those things that when, you know, you get a little taste of it and it keeps you going for, you know, slogging through the mud. You're like, I'm gonna get it again. God yeah. damn it. Whatever I have to do.
Speaking of slogging through the mud, I like to play sort of a game. It's more of a conversation starter with my guests where I'm going to go back through your IMDb page.
Ooh.
We're going to look at maybe some of your early roles, maybe some of your big, I'm getting some feedback that from listeners that we definitely want to hit on some of the bigger roles that actors have played, but I'm going to go pick some character names from your career. And you're going to tell me what show that was from.
Okay.
If you remember. And I can give you hints. This is Show Me Your Name.
Great.
The first one that comes up here that I'm looking at is Young Man Hostage. You played a young man who was a hostage on something. Does this ring any bells? I'll give you a hint.
The unit.
No, not the unit.
Okay.
2001. This has got to be an early...
Angel. Yes,
that's correct.
Yeah.
Very popular TV series. I would talk about, like, right away, pretty early on, getting your WB fix.
Can I tell you, that was my first audition in Los Angeles.
No way. And you booked it.
I booked my first, and then I booked my fourth. And I was like, this is easy. What is everybody talking about?
Tell me all about that. This is fantastic. So first of all, how did you make it in? I mean, we don't have enough time for all this, but you obviously made it out to LA, got an agent, and they send you out for Angel.
Well, yeah, I moved out to LA. I didn't know anyone. I mean, I did not know anyone. I don't know what the hell I was doing. And my dad called me one day and he goes, "It just hit me." And one of his best friends, Ira Rubenfeld, has this friend, Seth Feldman, who was a manager. And Seth was my one lifeline that I didn't even know that I had.
It's who you know.
And he was a really good guy for that period in my life. He was an ally, a friend. He, you know, we'd talk about dating and, you know, everything. And I'm just a little, you know, peon, you know, kid. Yeah, I had this audition, I guess, for Angel. I didn't get it. And then a couple days later, there was a scheduling conflict with somebody else, and I was able to do it.
Wow.
And then the fourth audition was for VIP, where I played a twin. It was Pamela Anderson's TV show.
Yes. This was the next one on my list, and I was going to ask about it.
Dude,
no, but great. Go into it. Character Bernard / Rhonda.
Rhonda. Okay, so, yeah, I play twin brother and sister. This was the final episode of VIP. And I guess Pamela Anderson didn't really, like, want to do it anymore. So they were just, they really, I mean, it was the Sam hour. Like, I
Your so big showcase was the series finale of VIP.
Of VIP. And so Bernard and Rhonda, they come from this legacy of, from this chocolate factory company. And Bernard kidnaps Rhonda, and then he poses as Rhonda to try and get this $1 billion chocolate formula. And this is fun fact about that is I got paid twice. I got paid for both characters, and I got paid less for the woman.
Whoa. Well, yeah. We shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
So that is crazy. So wow. So yeah. Wow. Weird. So weird.
Yeah.
So did you play a biological cisgender woman as well, or did you just play Bernard disguised as Rhonda in like drag?
No, I like there's all these, you can find it online and it's
I'm watching this immediately.
It's a pretty fun watch. No, there's like scenes where like I'm talking to me and like, yeah, I played the brother and the sister.
Yes.
And then the brother dressing up as the sister, and yeah, it was
wow.
Quite a moment.
It sounds like it. Was Pamela Anderson like, by the way, you're killing it?
No. She was actually, I think there was some drama with Tommy Lee at the time.
Wow.
You
were so like, close to being a supporting role in Pam and Tommy on Hulu. You're
I know.
So close.
God damn it. No, I did like 5 scenes with her, never once talked to her. At the very, towards the end, I was like, hi Pamela, I'm Sam. And she's like, oh, hi, how are you? Are they treating you well on set? She was preoccupied, we'll say.
Yeah,
that.
Okay, got it. I've been on sets like that before. Wow, I gotta look this one up. That's great. How about this one? River, okay. Phoenix.
Yeah. That was for British television.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, excuse me.
That was cool. Yeah, I OD'd on Hollywood Boulevard. We it was like a reenactment thing for, you
Got
know.
Got it. Death by Excess is the name of the program. It's a TV miniseries documentary.
Yeah.
So you reenacted River Phoenix's death scene at the Viper Room. Wow.
Yeah.
Did they shoot it here?
Yeah, they did. And when we were doing when I was ODing, people came running over to us and they thought I was dying, and that was kind of heavy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sad.
Not,
he died.
It's very sad. Also, like, not like that. I feel like that's definitely like it's not on the bucket list, but like, it's rare that you get to play in your career like another famous actor. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, totally. And there's something cool about it. There's something that, I don't know, channeling somebody who's kind of, I don't know, in this field doing this thing that we're doing.
An icon. Have you played any other roles that are based on real people?
I did this awesome There Will Be Blank. It was or Greystone. I can't actually remember.
Greystone, yes. I'm looking at it right here.
Okay. So this awesome video artist. She's in like the art world, which was the first time I'd ever worked in the art world as opposed to like the entertainment industry. So do you know Greystone Mansion?
I've heard, you know, this is Greystone Mansion is one of those locations in LA that I've heard about. I've never been to. Can you tell us what it is?
It's this beautiful, massive estate that I believe was built in the late 1800s. But they, you know, they have like museum tours and, you know, things of that. But how it was built by this guy. I don't know why he was so rich, but the house manager and him, they were lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this double murder suicide. Yeah, this double murder suicide. And so what Carrie did, there have been hundreds of films that were shot at Greystone, like Scooby-Doo and
I thought you were gonna name like a very classic film. from like, you know, some like, and it's Scooby-Doo. That's great.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think like it's like Scooby-Doo and, you know, Total Recall. And I mean,
yeah.
So just an arsenal of.
Yeah, it's a big film location. If you need a big gothic-y looking mansion in L.A., you shoot there.
So she took all all of these scripts, I mean thousands of scripts, and cut and pasted lines from all of these films that were shot in Greystone to tell the story of this double murder suicide. And there's photos of the crime scene with the two dead bodies, and I was like playing this guy lying in the same exact spot where he was either murdered or killed himself.
Channeling a lot of like dying people.
Yeah.
In these roles, it seems like.
There has been a lot of that. That's been a theme. Well, I mean, I don't know if you know, but I guess I do play a lot of dark and complicated characters.
What do you think it is about you that they're like, all right, we need a Swedish, you know, crack addict to, you know, or we need, I mean, obviously I can see the resemblance with River Phoenix, but like even in Batwoman, your character in Batwoman, Mouse, seems very, you know, dark. Obviously is a dark character. What is it Sam that, you know, people look at you and like, let's have him die on the floor of a mansion.
I don't totally know. I mean, I have always been really interested in the macabre, and I really like to talk about things. Like, I like to, like, get into the, I don't know if this is why I get these parts, but I guess I know why I gravitate to them. I really like to investigate, and I don't, light fluffy stuff is fun. I don't know if it really is what gets me going. I mean, when I was 9, I was into Phantom of the Opera about this guy who's living in a basement who's got this obsession with this girl that may or may not be his daughter. I mean, I was doing that at 9 fucking years old. So, or 8 or whenever I did that. Yeah, there's always been something about that that has, I guess, yeah, the darkness in us, investigating that, I don't know, it intrigues me.
I'll tell you what, you also got great hair for those roles. You know, watching your clips in Batwoman, I'm like, oh, if there's ever good hairstyle for Gotham City, it's this, you know what I mean? It's Sam's hair. Great
hair.
Well,
that wasn't my hair. Do you know? So
you wear it well.
No, that was all hair extensions. I was getting 10 hours worth of hair extensions done every 2 months.
Wow. 10, what does that mean? 10 hours? You have to sit there for 10 hours?
They're gluing individual, I mean, I think, yeah, they're gluing individual pieces of hair into your hair. And they have to take them out and put them back in over and over again, because otherwise your hair starts to dread up and...
Uh-huh.
That was aggressive, but
that sounds
fun.
Aggressive. I take it all back. Now I know it's really just the hair extensions. You were tortured, so I apologize. You also have... You've also did some prosthetic stuff for that role, too. You looked very phantomy, actually.
Well, I have, thank you. Oh, so that was my initial Phantom. I was like, oh my God, I get to play. It's not exactly Phantom, but there.
No,
yeah,
but it's, I can see the inspiration there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. When I booked this part, I called my friend and told her, and she's like, you love a makeup chair. I do. I always have, I always get these. I get a lot of jobs that just require, like, it's me and the makeup person, and we're just, like, in it, you know?
Yeah, I love that. What's it like, you know, that, working on something like Batwoman, that's something, you know, I'm a big comic book guy. I love comics, always been a fan. Haven't crossed over into the world of superhero TV or film. What's that like? What is it like being part of one of those big... you know, machine. I, but like that's the Warner. You know, it's Warner Brothers. It's DC Comics. What's it like stepping into that world as an actor?
You know, so when I booked the part, I immediately flew up to Vancouver and I did like 10 makeup tests and like seven or eight hair tests. Then they flew me down to LA. And then the next day they're like, you're getting on a plane and you're going to Chicago. And I get to Chicago and I have no idea what my character is because the audition was like a one page. It might as well have been like finger painting. It was like, I am you now there. I mean, there was just, I had no idea what I was doing.
Gotcha. Great. A nice reminder that sometimes actors don't know what they're doing and they can still book jobs if they just make a choice. Yeah. Just make a choice. Make those choices.
Totally. So I get to, my call time is noon. I am doing hair and makeup and then I get called to set at 1 a.m. We start filming the scene at 4:30 a.m. and we do all of her footage. Oh, and I'm supposed to be meeting the showrunner at some point and she's going to tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
And she had to leave because for scheduling issues. And so we're doing this scene with her and they're doing all of her coverage. Then they decide they're going to shoot another scene before they get to my coverage. Finally, they get around to me. It's 6:30 in the morning. The sun is rising. There's two film units going on at the same time. Batwoman is, I've never been on a show that has two units that are just constantly. What I'm getting to is it's all so fucking fast.
Right.
So it's 6:30 in the morning. Sun's rising. They're taking up the barricades. People are going to work. The street cleaning thing is going off. Beep, beep, beep. Beep, beep, beep. Walkie-talkies are going off. This guy comes up to us and he's like, I'm sorry, we got to shut this shit down. And the director's like, holy shit. So he goes, all right, you want to kill yourself. You just want to fucking kill yourself. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of do. So I got one take. I couldn't hear her. We had to dub the whole thing over later. And I got in my car and I was just like, what the fuck am I on? That was cool. Later, I was talking to a friend about it and he was like, well, Sam, now you know what it is. You know, because I was only supposed to be on it for two episodes.
Okay.
But he goes, now you know what it is. You know you're going to get one take. And my friend, he kind of attributed it, he sort of associated it to like being an opera singer. And the opera singer walks on, and it's them and the maestro, and the director is the, you know, maestro, and they're, you just gotta fucking crank it out and do it out in that one take. And I've, you know, I mean, throughout my whole career, it's been like, okay, I've got like maybe 6-7 takes to, oh, this feels all right, I've got it, da, da, da. And this one, I learned really early on. It's like this is all you get. You get this maybe two takes.
Yeah, sounds like a lot like, from what I understand, like soap opera acting, you know.
Yeah.
Where you're just like moving every day and you're like, you get one, you get two takes, you're there to serve the material and the show, and then you're out.
Because they're doing so much. I mean, it's so many fight, and like the stunt crew was so amazing. I mean, like what they were able to just constantly be cranking out. It's just a lot of material that they're covering over the course of 8 days in an episode. And I've never experienced that in my life.
Wow. Intense. That sounds wild. Sounds kind of like what it would be like to be a superhero.
Yeah.
Get one shot at some of this stuff. Sam, true. Thank you so much for talking and opening up. And I wish we had done this back in high school. Sorry. I don't have a superhero complex. I know I wouldn't be able to solve your problems, but like, I wish you'd felt like you had somebody there, back at Interlock. And I wish I could have, risen to that occasion, and we had this conversation back then. It's been a delight.
Well, I think it's just, I think it's really beautiful that we're here today and doing it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when you asked me to do it, I was really looking forward to it because I think it's cool to you know, investigate this stuff. And yeah, I'm a fan of yours, and I think what you're doing is great.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Okay, we're gonna say goodbye to Sam here. Before we do that, do you have anything you want to plug or social media links that people can find you if they want to follow you?
Yeah, I'm working on some. Oh, well, so on Instagram, I'm at the Sam Littlefield. I've been doing some really cool podcasts with this company, Q Code.
I saw that on your IMDb as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's been so awesome during the pandemic, you know, just recording these shows like this in my bedroom. But I have a one coming up that I'm working with Merritt Weaver, and called The End Up. So look out for that. And there's a bunch of other Q Code stuff that I've been doing that you, I guess anybody can go on IMDb, and because I can't remember all the names of all of them.
Well, let me help you out. I have it right here. How about Classified or
Classified's
Blackout?
Cool. Blackout's very cool. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Definitely check those out. Now, Sam will be joining me over on the Patreon, the Slate Your Name Green Room. Do you have a story you want to tease for our patrons of the art?
Yeah, we're giving a teaser. Okay.
What story are you going to be sharing?
It's about I got cast as the lead of this Chris Carter series, X-Files. Yeah, it was originally going to be a one-day role where I had to shave my head and get naked, and he ended up being the lead, and I had the most insane day of filming I think I will ever have in my entire life.
Okay, great. I can't believe we almost got through a conversation where we didn't talk about this. So we'll be doing that over in the green room. Sam, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, everybody, you can hear that story from Sam right over there. Right over there, I'm pointing at it. It's behind me, backstage. Again, weird theater, everybody. That's not weird for a green room to be backstage. Weird that I'm pointing at something you can't see and that doesn't actually physically exist. Join us over on the Patreon, patreon.com/slateyourname to hear that story. And I'm going to answer another question, the first part of the question from Joanna. This is a real backwards episode. I want to thank Sam Littlefield again for joining us. I loved that conversation. I want to thank Ryan Countshouse, who engineers and edits every one of these episodes. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you guys for listening. I will be back next week. Don't call me, I'll call you. Slate Your Name is executive produced by Ryan Countshouse and Michael McMillan, and engineered by Ryan Countshouse. Our theme music is by Riley Bray. Please like and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan of true crime.
Every week on our new podcast, Muriel's Murders, I handpick a real-life crime story that I think will blow Nick's mind.
Muriel is really enthusiastic about researching and telling me these stories, and boy, they are a lot.
Some of them are famous. Some of them are weirdly under the radar, but all of them contain crime, violence, and murder from across history and around the globe. How does that make you feel, Nikki?
Nervous.
Are you ready to hear a story?
No.
Too bad. Here comes Muriel's Murders.
So join us every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts, and check out the original Muriel's Murders animations on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok at Muriel's Murders.